This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, I understand you've recently been working on cases involving what's happened in Maui. And yeah. I'm very interested in hearing anything you can tell us about what's going on there. And it's one of obviously completely devastating. And even by the scale of things we're accustomed to seeing in our business, this is beyond anything I've ever seen. And I'm just wondering if you can give us any insight into that.
Well, I mean, first, my heart goes out to every single person there. The devastation, especially in Lahaina, is just unbelievable.
Have you been there on the ground?
I haven't. I've just been seeing everything. And one of our lawyers is already over there. And we've been working with Mark Davis, as you know, another Inner Circle lawyer. And just hearing about all the devastation just breaks my heart. Anybody who's licensed in Hawaii and is connecting with victims over there have been telling me stories about what everybody's been going through. And it sounds like one, maybe 2 degrees of separation between anybody in Maui and somebody who perished in the fires. And that is just a devastating situation to be in. Now, what's happening over there and all the investigation, I mean, this is the one of the few times I look at social media and I go, wow, how lucky are we that we have something like this? Because a lot of people in the community were filming events that were proceeding or moments when they witnessed it, and then the immediate aftermath of the electrical lines sparking and starting wildfires. So when we start looking at exactly what happened here, this is a much less complicated set of events evidentiary-wise to see what the failure mechanisms were, at least some of them. Now, the hard part is, are there other responsible entities or parties? And it's just too early to tell on any of that.
Well, they couldn't have found a better group of people to be investigating and working on that. And you guys have had enormous success in the California wildfire cases. Sadly, it seems like wildfires are going to be a good business for lawyers these days. But hopefully you can get to the bottom of it and find a way to help the families and people that lost loved ones there. But as we go forward, maybe you can keep us apprised of developments, because it's definitely something of human interest and national interest.
Definitely. And, you know, one of the things I tell everybody is that I hope through the cases I work on and all of our friends work on that we actually influence prevention so nothing like this ever happens again. And it's so frustrating sometimes to look and think that we accomplished so much in our litigation here in California, and other states and utility companies are not taking those lessons learned and implementing them to prevent other harms.
So with that, we're very excited to welcome Christian Morris to the podcast today. Christian is a stellar trial lawyer from Nevada, who in 2019 was named Nevada Trial Lawyer of the Year. He's had some huge verdicts, which I'm sure we'll get to. But most importantly, she shares an ancestral origin of growing up in the state of Maine, where I'm from. So we're really interested to hear your journey from the humble beginnings here in Maine to being trial lawyer of the year in the state of Nevada. So welcome, Christian.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
So why don't you, you were telling us before we went on air a little bit about growing up in Maine and your family here. And it sounds like some of your relatives are not trial lawyers, but you became one. So tell us, how did you go from growing up in a small, poor state like Maine to being trial lawyer of the year in the state of Nevada?
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, being from Maine, as you probably know, you never consider yourself anything but a maniac. So I have very strong roots in Maine. And I really do think that the way I was raised shapes the way that I practice law and the way that I approach some of the situations, like Rahul was just saying, is that, you know, the work that we do, the image is so different from the reality of the changes that we're making. And so that's something, when I grew up, I didn't have any exposure to lawyers. No one in my family was a lawyer. I didn't have any dreams of being a lawyer. I was raised in rural Maine, up near Sugarloaf. It's called Lexington. We lived on a mountain. We were the only year-round residents. So we had no electricity, no running water. We were homeschooled. We lived completely off the land. So it was very rustic. It was very isolated, but it was very wholesome. So it was a lot of hard work. We worked the gardens in the summer. We had to take care of the goats and the pigs and all of the things, the chickens. We had like 60 chickens all the time. We had more eggs than you could ever imagine. It was a very interesting experience because I didn't have this kind of perspective of competition at school or what I should be, or should I be better than that, or should I be like this person. I just had my sisters and my family, and we kind of just existed that way without any of those external pressures, which I'm actually been very grateful for, because that's helped me in this profession where there's a lot of images. There's a lot of ideas of what you should be perceived as. And it took me a while to catch on to that. And so I'm still evolving and still kind of catching on to that. But that helped me a lot in staying kind of grounded in the work that we do and kind of the big picture of what's really important, because growing up for me, family was everything. And so I got that instilled early on, and I'm very grateful for it. But I was also grateful when we moved and had electricity and then the toilet flushed. We didn't have to clean out our own outhouse come spring. That was really nice. So we moved to Augusta, where my grandfather was, and I went to public school. And my freshman year, I was scared to death. I did not know how to use a locker. I sat in the math room and ate lunch because I just didn't understand. I remember I went to Banana Republic and bought t-shirts and Gap and bought some jeans because it looks like that's what everyone was wearing. So my first quiz was like a 5-question quiz. I think I studied like 3 hours for it because I just didn't know. I mean, they were like, what's your hypothesis? I'm like, a hypo what? Because we just kind of had alternative homeschooling, which was great for me because I was really good at math, because we used the self-teaching math. And so I got 110 in pre-algebra, but I was like, I don't understand what we're doing in geography, because it just wasn't something we focused on. It was an interesting experience for me to kind of integrate. And I learned to be very quiet and to watch and to kind of sometimes mimic what I thought was the way I should be, because I didn't have that guidance. And my second oldest sister went in her junior year, and my oldest sister went in her senior year. So it was even harder for them because they didn't have this kind of group of friends that you build through high school. And so I learned a lot by watching people, watch how they interact, try to not stick out too much like a sore thumb. And then I started doing things like bartending and waitressing. And I worked in the hospitality industry for 10 years. And I still feel like I work in the hospitality industry. What we do is truly customer service. And the customer is our client, and the customer, in my mind, will always be right, because someone needs to stand up for them. The world is against them. The insurance companies are after us. Defense counsel's berating them. The judges sometimes aren't on our side. So we are an island together. And so I kind of learned a lot about that by working in customer service. And I worked in politics because my grandmother was a state senator in Maine. And so she used to have me come and page at the Senate. And I did mailing lists, and I did a lot of knocking on doors, which is a great way to accept rejection, because you get yelled at and you get turned away. And then I went to DC and I worked for Senator Collins. And so I was down there and I interned and I did some of her scheduling. And so in politics is where I kind of learned the people who make the laws are lawyers. The people who are writing down there and the ones who really understand the changes are lawyers. And at that point, I had gone to the University of Southern Maine. I commuted from Augusta because I didn't want to live in the big city of Portland. And I got a bachelor's degree in political science, and it qualified me to be an administrative assistant or a bartender. You know, there isn't really much you can do with it. So from there, I really decided, like, I've got to figure out something that will get me where I can make a difference, because life is meant to be lived. And I do like taking care of myself and I love taking care of my family, but that's just not enough. I really want to make an impact. I want to have a position where I'm a mentor, where they can think back, and the way I think of my grandmother, the woman made a difference. She was the first woman in Maine who passed the Senate law that allowed the Indians to keep their land and build their casinos on it and or keep their water rights. And she was really impactful. And I remember thinking, I would love to be like that. And so that's really what got me down the path, which ended up turning into being a trial lawyer, which was never really something that was anything I would have ever considered growing up or anything anyone ever told me I should be.
Wow, that's an incredible story.
I tend to talk more on sentences too. I could go for the whole hour without breathing.
That was amazing.
You share that with most trial lawyers.
So what happened in your life where it actually, you hit that fork in the road and became a trial lawyer?
So I was working at a lobbying firm in DC. I had no idea where I wanted to go to law school. I wanted to go in Maine and they didn't accept me. So I had applied all over and I got to Pepperdine and Cal Western. And so I'd never been to California. I flew out, I landed in LA, I drove up to Pepperdine and went down to San Diego. And California Western had a poster in the basement of an attorney in a suit with the pant legs rolled up holding a surfboard. And I thought, that's cool. I'd like to do that. So I did that. I drove across country with a U-Haul. I bought myself a longboard, funboard, surfboard, and rented an apartment off of a girl from Craigslist and really kind of got into this idea, wow, you have to be smart in law school. And I've never really considered myself smart. I've considered myself more like, give me the baton and I'll run. If it needs to be done, I'm going to get it done, but I'm not someone who sits and concentrates and is a deep thinker. And you meet a lot of those in law school where they've got these massive outlines. And the first semester, I did not do well. I was actually put on probation and I was studying with groups of people. And so after that, of course, I did not want to fail. So I just started studying my own way. By myself, I'd get up in the morning, I'd go to Dog Beach, I'd surf, I'd come back, I'd study. And I figured out my way of doing it. And I andered like three classes the second semester. So they made me a tutor to kids for the rest of the law school for who were really struggling, because I just needed to do it my way. And so while I was in law school, it was a lot of sitting, a lot of reading, not really something I was used to. I had just always been moving, you know, either working on the farm or working in restaurants or going door to door. And I'm always in a moving job. And so I was struggling with, I was really good at contracts, but man, it was just a lot of reading and writing. And I did an internship at the DA's office and the public defender's office. And I thought, these are my kind of people. They're kind of like quick on the draw. There's not a ton of heavy writing. Everyone's kind of supportive of each other. And I really liked that atmosphere. So I was determined. I was like, I was going to be San Diego district attorney. And they had a hiring freeze. And they weren't hiring anyone. And I had done a summer out here at an insurance defense firm. And they had paid me $22,000 for the summer, which was like amazing for me. And so I thought, well, it's good money. And because I couldn't get a job, I thought, I'm going to come to Nevada. I'm going to work for a year here. I'm going to take the California bar. I'm going to go back to California. And I came out here and the work was exactly what I knew I wouldn't like. I mean, it was just so much sitting and writing and not to be mean, but judgmental. I mean, oh, that period isn't where it should be. And I'm like, does that change the course of anything? So, you know, I really struggled with it. But what happened is I had a friend who I loved dearly. She and I went to law school together, lived together and worked together for 8 years. She had settled a case with a PI attorney here in town. And he said, I want you to come and work for me. And she said, I'll only come if you hire my friend Christian, because she really likes like being in the courtroom. She and I had done trial team together, and I'd really liked trial team in law school. And I had worked for this really old PI attorney during law school in San Diego. Like, he would dictate and I would like type into the typewriter. But I love that the clients came in and he'd sit in the conference room and talk to them. And it, to me, I hadn't had exposure to personal injury. And I was like, wow, he's a real person with these people. This is so cool. Maybe I could be a real person again too, since I was so busy pretending to be a lawyer. And so I went over to this PI firm with my friend, and I mean, it was, there were files and drawers. I mean, it was just so, you know, client came in, was like threatening violence if we didn't have his check. And I'm like, oh, but a couple of weeks in, there was a trial and it was my friend's trial. And she's like, do you want to help me with it? And I'm like, oh my gosh, absolutely. Like, get me out of the office, get me down to court. And so we went down to court, and it was, well, it was what any first trial would be if you've never seen a trial or never had anyone mentor you on how to try a case. It was a bench trial, thank goodness, on a case that the judge never would have given a plaintiff's verdict anyways. And the client was, there was a lot going on emotionally with him. And I sat down and the defense counsel looked over and said, are you first chair? And I'm like, well, no, I'm like a half chair, because we were sharing the trial. And it was the best and worst week. We got a defense verdict. So I figured, well, there's nowhere but up from here. But I loved it. I loved standing up and saying exactly what I thought needed to be said and the way that I saw the case. We had a video, which was pretty much a disaster for us, but I thought maybe I can twist it in some way. Maybe it's a Hail Mary. Someone's going to catch my ball in the end zone. And no one did. But from then on, any time, and there were so many cases that, frankly, when cases aren't cared for, they end up in trial. Those are the ones that end up in trial are the ones that have been completely missed. Cared for, or the ones that are so difficult that they need to be tried because they're wobbler, or the ones that are of so much value, you cannot get the full value unless you go to trial. And so I just started trying any case that and no one was interested in, because I was scared of the courtroom. I used to wear pants because my legs would shake and I didn't want anyone to see it. And I knew that the only way I could get better was to do it. Because I'd never learned by watching. I'd only ever learned by doing. I had watched people to see how I should act, but I couldn't really kind of take in true skills unless I was standing up and doing it. And that's just the way I've always been. Some people can watch and learn a lot. I learn and remember when I physically do it myself. And so I started trying cases, and one of the judges was like, oh, I heard about you. You're that girl down at the courthouse. We'll try anything. And I was like, well, yeah, that's me. And I thought, well, I've really got to work on my skills. I've really got to figure out what to do. And the Nevada Justice Association is amazing. I asked every question that I needed to ask. I had no shame in my game that I did not know. And I loved that it didn't bother me because I shouldn't know. And so many times people are like, oh, you haven't done that before. Well, no, how, we're only one human in one life. And so we're supposed to just know everything. And that's physically impossible, but it's also a lot of pressure on us as lawyers, as trial lawyers, to have to act like we know everything. And so I, luckily at that time, I had no perception of what I might appear to be as I'm desperately asking every question in the book, because I was just trying to get better. And from that, I learned kind of that not everyone tries cases. I thought when I started trying cases that this is what people did. I had no idea that it was the few, the far, and the brave that truly are down there, you know, taking the hits. When I kind of understood that, I really wanted to make it more accessible for every lawyer, especially young lawyers, to get in the courtroom, to make their mistakes on the cases that can afford the mistakes. Because if you wait, and if you have fear, and if you want it to be perfect, you will never try a case. And that's where I started to learn that I would, as I got older and I was interviewing attorneys, they would be 10 to 12 years out and they've never tried a case. And the problem with that is they look like they should know at that point. And they don't, because they didn't get in there early. And so that's one of the reasons I've structured my firm the way I have. All of my attorneys are my law clerks that I hired out of law school and trained. and or I hired just recently a girl who just passed the bar and was a law clerk for a friend of mine. And I get them in the courtroom. So I've got an attorney. She's 2 years out. She's done 6 trials with me. She's taken witnesses. She hasn't done voir dire or opening yet. But I need to create trial lawyers in the way that I wish I had had that ability to not have to do all of these things that I admit to. And a lot of people wouldn't want to. And it's not that it's great for my career to say so. But that's how I transitioned into a trial lawyer and went to the Jerry Spence method is now the name of it. And I teach up there. And I learned and connected with people. And I'm not a book reader. Like, I can't read through a book and take a ton from it. But what I will do is before any trial, I will skim a book and take inspiration from it. And so that's why I like to have the books, but I can't read through them and be like, okay, this is how I'm going to try a case. I can't pull things from that. But I found ways for the way that I learned to be inspired by, if I can go to a conference and learn 2 things, winning, because I will implement immediately those 2 things. I won't have them in a shelf and think, oh, later on I'll use it. I start using it then and there. I was just up teaching at the ranch in Wyoming in June, and Johnny Zelps taught me 2 things for voir dire. And I was like, and he's like, oh, Christian, you taught me something. I'm like, no, you taught me that. And I immediately went home, did a focus group and implemented it into my voir dire. Cause I'm like, ooh, I love that. And I want to use it. And I don't want to put it in a notebook on a shelf and not come back to it. I want to immediately implement something that catches me. And so it's really been a journey of figuring out, how do I navigate through this profession in the way that I've learned that I can function, but also have it helpful for other attorneys, because more of us in the courtroom is golden. I mean, that's where our power comes from. Our power as plaintiff's attorneys comes from communication. It comes from our strength together. It comes from supporting each other. It comes from allowing people to make mistakes, improve, and get as many of us successful as possible. Because the more of us in the courtroom winning, the more powerful we are, because we don't have insurance companies backing us. We don't have a corporation that's just behind us. It is us as the people, as the scrappers alone down there with each other, making sure the value of our life and our safety has worth. Because if we're not there, there is no one to protect us, which is why I've gotten more into the lobbying and everything that I can do. Because other than that, corporations and insurance companies will eat us alive. And I completely say that and believe it. Before I'd be like, oh, that sounds like a conspiracy. I believe it with every bone in my body that we are the last line of defense as humanity for what a company says we're worth. And it's scary. But that's why the more of us together down at the courtroom, the stronger we can be and the more power we have to be able to make sure that we can maintain at least what we've been able to accomplish, if not more.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Are there particular cases that were turning points or kind of the most formative in your trial career that you think back on and think, well, I really took a lesson from that, or that was a big moment for me where I was able to accomplish that in this particular case?
There's one, of course, that I remember it fondly because we cite it all the time here, Foster versus Costco, which changed the law in Nevada on premises liability. And I remember it because I tried the case when no one really wanted to invest in it. I had just come back from the Jerry Spence method. And they said, Christian, someone will always save you in the audience. You know, in your, so you ask it, you keep your hand up, someone will save you. You know, a juror will say, I see what you're saying, or something like that. And so I came back and the case had just come back down from the Supreme Court. So he had been at Costco. There was a pallet. He testified, he saw the pallet but there was a box on the edge of the pallet, so we couldn't appreciate the edge. So it had been dismissed on summary judgment because it was an open and obvious condition. And the Supreme Court did the right thing and said, well, just because it's open and obvious doesn't mean that the landowner is free from liability if they created the hazard. And you have to look at, maybe he was looking at the displays, maybe he was, something was blocking his view, maybe he was looking at a sale rack, things like that. And so I came back, and he was I love Stephen. He lived in a trailer in Pahrump. He came in with his dog on our first meeting, and it threw up all over my carpet. And he's just a determined man, though. Real like salt of the earth. And he's like, all right, you want to go to trial? Go to trial. And I had his little headphones on him because he had a hard time hearing. And I cleaned him up. I was like, you got to clean your nails. Got to get you ready for trial. And so we went in there, but it was a case that was so old. And he was so old by the time it went to trial, because it had been dismissed, Supreme Court, all the way back down. And so I had just come back from the Jerry Spence method where you get really creative. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try this PI case with no doctor and no medical records, because I had found a case where the woman had fallen at a buffet, and because she had limited mobility, the jury could objectively see her injury, and you don't need an expert if there's an objective injury. And so Stephen had a rotator cuff tear, he'd had a surgery to his hand, he had a scar, he had limited rotation. And so I was in voir dire, and I said to the jury, you know, does anyone here feel as though they would have difficulty coming to a verdict for a medical injury where there was pain and suffering and disability, if they never heard from a doctor and if they never saw a medical record? Did anyone here feel like they could come to a verdict if you never see that? And everyone's like, we couldn't do that for you. So the jury did, though, in the end, because I had him demonstrate on the stand, and I told them all it takes is the testimony of one witness of belief to come to a verdict in accordance with that testimony. And so if you think that Stephen got on the stand and he lied to you about the surgery that he went under, and that scar wasn't from the surgery, then your verdict should be for the defense. But there's a very experienced defense attorney over here, and if they had any evidence to contradict his testimony, they would have shown it to you. They would have put it up there in black and white. And the jury came to a verdict for him, and it was $200,000. They gave him 50% comparative. So I only get 100 Costco paid because I just wanted to be done. But I remember that because I was so like, this is so outside the box. And it made me feel more comfortable in being more outside the box, because we are so trained to think and act a certain way. And so that was pivotal for me, because I was thinking, am I really doing an injustice to my client here by not doing the conventional things? And so that was a great one for me. And then the other one that I really love is the O'Connell versus Wynn case, only because the situation was, I was her sixth attorney, and the case was very difficult, and I had been so reasonable. The trial was very obvious that she was a 10 out of 10 on every part of her body, from the top of her head to the tip of her toe. And the defense wanted to make that a big thing and, you know, mock her essentially, which they really did. And the judge was very unfriendly. But I had been so reasonable and dropped this really low offer of judgment for $38,500. She had 50 grand in meds, but I didn't put the meds in because I couldn't quite figure them out. And they had offered $5,000. And so it was a slip and fall at the win. And the jury came back with $400,000, but 40% comparative to 60. So bad at math. I should be good at math, but I used to be good at math. So 240. So either way, I had fully beaten this offer of judgment. And so I hadn't really at that point done so many big trials that I was putting in my time and my cost, because I don't keep my time. I'm a plaintiff's lawyer. And the judge said, well, you know, so I said, I beat my offer of judgment. She said, well, you aren't going to get anything because you didn't put your time in. And I said, well, Your Honor, I don't keep my time. And that was honest. So many times we had to go back and like try to recreate our time. And I told her, I don't keep my time. And so she said, well, you don't get anything. I said, but I've been in trial with you for 8 days. You saw me. Can I get at least that? And she said, no. So they appealed the verdict. And so I just cross appealed. And, you know, it was one of my first in-house appeals, because I usually farm them out. But this isn't one that I could invest on that. And so I did my own in-house cross appeal. And the appellate court affirmed the verdict and then wrote, I think it's like a 20-page decision, that attorneys who put their time and their money on the line get their contract rate. They don't have to keep their time because we are making sure there's access to justice for people who cannot afford attorneys. And it was a really great decision. It really was. And it came out of just, and that's what I found. It comes out of just hard work. Nothing great about it. Just determination, not giving up, finding creative solutions to difficult cases. And that was something that I've learned because big verdicts are amazing. And I will tell you that that verdict for the Giacalone case, when I stood there and the verdict came in, I was like, this is going to change my career. And I knew it. I knew it because suddenly people are like, wow, she might be a good attorney. Like, yes, I have been a good attorney. It's just, you have to get the cases and people have to trust you. And as a female, not a lot of people running to me is like, oh, this girl looks like she knows what she's doing, because it's just a different world. There's an image of attorneys. That's something that's changing, but it's something that I certainly experienced. I mean, I remember I got trial lawyer of the year. I was in Reno. The gala was that night. And the next morning, of course, because I'm like Miss Efficient, I had scheduled a deposition the next day. You know, I walk in and just got this award and they thought it was the court reporter. You know, like the day after, I'm like, ah. But on the same note, I don't take it in any kind of like, oh, this is so unfair, because underestimation has been historically my best trial skill. I always, oh, I got the kids, you know, I'm so busy. Little did I know, like up all night getting ready for everything. But that's been something that for me, that was pivotal because one, I mean, I needed that verdict for that family. I was sitting beside when the verdict came in for, and the dad's like, are you shaking? And I'm like, my whole body is shaking. Like my whole body was shaking because I desperately needed to fix what had happened to that family. But when I was standing there, I acknowledged the fact that, look, all of a sudden it's going to be like, wow, you can bring in a big verdict. But the reality is most of the time, a big verdict is because there are epic damages, devastating damages. You're not going to get $20 million on a case where you don't have the evidence for it. And that's kind of a thing as well, is that we have to understand that and have perspective, because the small verdicts make major differences. Those two cases I talked about, I'm not retiring on them. I'm never retiring, frankly, because I don't know what else I would do. But that's where I need people to really look at those things too and appreciate them. There's an attorney I know in town who just went up to the Jerry Spence method, and he's tried two cases since he came back, and they are small cases. And I am so proud of him. He didn't know something. He called me. Did he say, I feel stupid that I don't know? Yeah. Did I say I care? No. Because if you're going to ask the question, if you're going to make the mistakes, do it on the smaller ones. And we can't act like we don't make mistakes or make decisions that maybe we would change in the future. They have to be done on the right cases. And it doesn't mean we're doing a disservice to the clients, because they're getting a trial from someone who cares, which is the most important thing. You've got to have an attorney that cares. And I'm so proud of him because he hit the ground running and he is doing it. And I told him, you are down at the courthouse doing it. You are putting it, and you know, there's nothing worse than losing. It's awful. My ego takes a massive hit. I sit in my closet. I cry for a while. My husband's like, great, we have to leave her alone. Because I take it extremely personally that I let someone down who trusted me. But also that I have to say, and maybe I'm not a great attorney. Maybe I'm not good. And we all struggle with that. But the one thing I don't struggle with, and I know that is something that we deal with in our career, is imposter syndrome. I don't have it because I don't claim to be anything more than I will try my hardest. I have learned the skills that I need. I will get everything done that needs to be done, but I am not a magician. And I think that that's something that we as attorneys think that maybe we can just fix everything. And some things, the other day when I got that defense verdict, I saw it coming a mile away. And I told the client, I don't think this is going to go well. And I tried my darndest, but there's some things I just couldn't fix. But she wanted her day in court with a qualified attorney to do it. And I was able to give her that. And so it's really kind of a mental balance. In addition to the pressures of, you get an email and this motion just got filed and, oh, what's the law say about that? And there's a lot of things to balance, but being a trial lawyer is truly the coolest job in the whole wide world, because you get to make changes. And there's nothing better than driving to court on closing argument day. It feels like Christmas. Like, what are you going to get in the stocking? It might be coal, but it might be something amazing. And that high of getting that amazing verdict, or getting that verdict that's so hard earned, it sits with me for like a month. I feel great. And everything's a little bit easier because I checked that off. And so everything else just kind of flows. And so it's kind of a personal addiction, right? It's your high if you can get that for it. But the clients, I mean, I tried a wrongful death case last year and I knew I was going to get a big verdict on it because it was a wrongful death case and it was tragic. And I did it for the family so they could get that justice that they needed, you know, and they were there with their shirts on, with their daughter on it. And, you know, I mean, it was their kind of second goodbye to her. And so I love that I can take it with the confidence now. I know I can walk in there and get the verdict on the cases that I know I can get the verdict on. And there are other ones where I'm like, well, we're going to try real hard and see what happens. And so I think the transparency of the struggles that we go through make our profession so much more accessible than just sitting on a panel talking about major verdict numbers. I don't know that that helps our profession. I don't know if it helps our image. I think it makes some people think that they're not good enough to try a case. And so I'm always cautious to do it because the realities of how you really become a trial lawyer are not glamorous in any way, shape, or form in my experience. But I think if you're transparent about it, people will think, well, maybe I can do it too, which is what I really want, especially for females. I mean, people say, how do you do it, Christian? You've got a 3 and a 5-year-old, a husband, a house, you've got 30 employees, a firm, you know, you travel. I've done 11 trials in 16 months, been back to back. The reality is I don't do it all. I have a team of women that run my house, take care of my children, do my grocery shopping, return my Amazon stuff. And that might sound diva-ish, but I'm a woman and I have to make sure that the kids are fed, that they're enrolled in school, that the housekeeper comes, that the lawn guy comes. I have to do all those things too. I'm not able to. And so I found people who support me and make it possible. They take care of me. I take care of them. You know, we go on trips. I'm like, whatever you guys want to eat, because I can't function without them. And so I don't do it all. It's impossible. And I think that the idea of a work-life balance, if you're a trial lawyer, people ask me about it. And I'm like, I have no idea what that is. No one ever taught me it and I don't understand it. And so I don't have to worry about it because it's not something that I'm concerned about. I want to live life and I want to make impacts and I want to be a good role model for my children and for the people around me. And that's important for me. And I struggle just like everybody else with maybe I'm not doing it right, but in just doing it my way. And I've become more comfortable in that as I'm aging.
So what, if anything, what makes you, do you get nervous before any trial? And what is it that causes you to get nervous?
So I get nervous for every trial. I get nervous before all big hearings. I've got a case against Nick Carter and he came in the courtroom and I was like, oh, it's Nick Carter. So I get nervous and I found ways to handle those. I get up every day and I work out in the morning. I've built a home gym. Every day at trial, I work out before trial. That has helped me immensely. But what's really helped me is that I don't do it alone anymore. So whenever I have a big hearing, I bring an associate attorney with me. And I always have associate attorneys and paralegals and tech people at trial. What I have done is I have learned how to get out of my own head by having other people around me and talking about things that aren't related to the trial or the hearing right before it starts. Because my nerves come right before it starts, right? Like walking to the courthouse. And so I'll be on the phone with someone while we're driving and I'll get there and be like, girl, I love those shoes. Or, you know, oh my gosh, I forgot my banana. Like I found ways that I'm distancing my nerves and that works great for me. And I'll even be chatting with them when like the judge takes the stand. I've learned to distract myself because the nerves can be overwhelming. And for a long time, I got like hives because I was extremely stressed and it would like crawl up my neck and I'm like, oh. And so I tried all these different medications and I was like, I need to learn how to manage my stress. So working out and keeping people around me that are supportive and we're talking about things that aren't related to, because I'm already prepared And, you know, if you're overly prepared, that's the worst way to begin. Like voice is shaking and you sound like you've memorized it. And so that natural flow. And then whenever I stand up to do an opening statement, I always say in the back of my head, once upon a time, Christian, and then I'll start my story because that helps me segue. And then where it's just people, especially jury selection, first impressions matter 100%. So that is my most important time when I stand up and I introduce myself and I introduce who I want to talk about and I have a very short statement. I am always extremely professional because I know that they're wondering whether I know what I'm doing when I stand up. But then when I stand up to actually do voir dire, I'm thinking these people are my friends. And I'm wondering how many of my friends can stick around. I mentally say that to myself because other than that, I would be scared of them because they're like, are they going to ruin my case? So I've done things in my head to say, these are my friends. Which friends can I keep? And so that helps me deal with that because it's manifested. Stress manifests in so many different ways. And over my career, it's manifested it differently. And so in every way that I've experienced the stress, I've found ways to distract myself from it because it's truly self-induced. We're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah, it's so well stated. And even though you know it's self-induced and somewhat of a fiction you're imposing on yourself, it's still real.
Yeah.
And you got to deal with it. I'm interested. I know it. You referenced it before, but I am interested in hearing the backstory of that case where you got your $31 million verdict, just because it sounds really interesting. And I would like to know a little bit more about what the story of that case is. Can you tell us?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a case that I didn't have originally, like many cases. Not much had gone on with it. It was just kind of there. And I picked it up and I thought, wow, this is a really interesting case. And it kind of had the reputation as the peanut butter case. And so I started like digging into it. And I thought, well, this is really, I mean, first of all, it was just epically tragic. Beautiful model from LA out here for a convention. She had a peanut allergy. She bit into a pretzel. It had peanut butter in it. She started to have a reaction. She went to the bathroom. She gave herself her EpiPen. She went to the medic area to get help. And from there, since she cannot tell us what happened, you know, she went into full anaphylaxis, cardiac arrest. I think she was out for 26 minutes. It was a lot. Mm. And quadriplegic and lives in her parents' dining room. And they take full care of her. Best care you could ever get in the whole wide world. She's never even had a bed sore. It's phenomenal. So it was the damages were, I mean, who's going to argue that? Liability was a major issue in many areas where who put out the pretzel? Her friend had brought her the pretzel. Was it such a bad reaction that this would have happened anyways, irrespective of her not getting the IV epinephrine she needed? I had brought in, you know, Mandalay Bay, the convention, the company that had put the pretzel out and hadn't labeled it with the allergen, and then Medic West, which was the ambulance company that was staffed at Mandalay Bay. And so the case really evolved. The theory of it, which was originally pled in the complaint, was not what went to trial. I was able to amend the complaint, I think, 4 years later. It was a very different theory because there wasn't enough information when the complaint was filed, and they thought it was a failure to intubate, but the medics don't have intubation skills. And the theory was very different, and so there was a lot of things that needed to be done. So I took over 50 depositions in the case, flew out, met with the family, and I'll never forget when I went and met with the family. I didn't have children, and by the time the case went to trial, I had two. And I went into the house, and I met with the family, and I met Chantel. And I told her, you know, when we get a verdict on this, we'll get you a lovely, like, name brand bag. She kind of reacted. She and I are, you know, very similar, actually. She's very, like, outgoing. And I watched home videos. And she'd do, like, her family's makeup. And that's something that I used to do. I mean, we had a lot in common. And I love Chantel's dad. We're family. We're still close. We text. And I was in the house. And I watched what her mom did. And I left. And I thought, I just saw true love. For the first time in my whole life, I saw true love. And I didn't really put it together because we always think about you get married and you meet your love. But that family had true love for her. And I'm telling you, cannot have empowered me more. And I had gone out there because this case was with another attorney. I introduced myself and I was like, you can trust me. I will take care of your daughter's case. I needed them to know that because they didn't know me. And, you know, it had been with another attorney, and that's a lot of times you have to go out there. And I wanted them to know. And I left there and I thought, gosh, I really hope they trust me with this case, because I will go to the mat and I will do whatever it takes to get this family what they need. And they did. And it was great that I was able to kind of fix some of the issues. And I videotaped every single deposition, and I had a ton of attorneys on the other side. But what's so funny is I didn't go to trial against all of the parties. I just went to trial against Medic West. But one of the attorneys for another party, because that all got resolved, she saw me after the trial and she said, Christian, I got to tell you, when you picked up this case, my partner came in and he said, you better watch out for that girl. And I was like, really? Because the only time I'd interacted with the partner is on a short trial where he was the short trial judge and I'd lost. But he said when the jury was out, because they were deliberating for like 3 hours on this one day trial, because I put the trial on real short. And he's like, pigs are flying, Christian. They're even thinking about this. It was nice to hear that, because they obviously resolved and didn't get the heat of the trial. But knowing that you're in there on the small cases, it's not a great resolution. You don't know if that's forecasting to the other side. And those parties were smart to not go to trial. Because one of the reasons I think this case went to trial against Medic West was underestimation of me as a trial lawyer. Because they allowed a case to go to trial with a beautiful, loving family and a beautiful human who was now a quadriplegic, who couldn't even swallow. And to take that risk, they really took the risk. It's a huge risk. That case, I mean, getting the verdict was amazing because it spoke for the family. But what I was able to do even before we got to trial was get a great outcome for the family already. And that's because of trying the smaller ones. They know you're, heaven forbid, you give this girl a good case, because that's the message that you send when you do the smaller ones. And so that case was phenomenal. I mean, when I did jury selection on it, when the forewoman stood up to speak during jury selection, I knew if I kept her, she would be my foreperson. First time I'd ever been able to do that. And then there was another juror that I wasn't sure about. He was young and he brought up the hot coffee case in Voir dire. But he loved plants. And I thought, and I was on the fence, you know, and I was like, well, he has plants. You know, people who have plants are good people. I can't keep a plant alive for the life of me. But when the jury was talking to us, he spoke up. And Chantel's dad on the stand had talked about the fact that she loved to go to Disney World and she loved the fairy princesses. And that was his favorite memory of her. And after the verdict came in, the young juror, video gamer, you know, I wouldn't expect it from him. He said, I want them to take that money, and you know what they're going to do? They're going to airlift her to Disneyland, and they're going to wheel her around, and people are probably going to stare at her, but they won't care. And she's going to be able to see the fairy princesses. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. You know, what people can do with the information you give them. So, I mean, that was a great verdict. It was a great outcome. It was deserving of the number. And maybe, you know, of course, as attorneys, maybe it should have been more. It was the right number for the case. And it was what needed to be done. And luckily, it's not even on appeal. So the family can rest in peace and not have to worry about all of the things that come after trial, because the battle doesn't usually end. That was great. And it was during COVID. We were down at the convention center. We're wearing masks. I was suing a first responder during a pandemic. They're all in there lined up in their suits. But the defense was very, like I will say, I do believe that they underestimated me. They waived their opening after I did my opening. I've never had that happen before. They did a later opening, which was basically a rebuttal opening, which I got to shut most of that down. But what had happened is I had really changed my theme in the case into money, where before it was really lack of training. This, and that I had found in answers to interrogatories that it only cost $2.42 to put this IV epinephrine in. And IV epinephrine, you know, goes bad if you don't use it. And they weren't using it a lot. So my theory of the case turned into the money, which I think really threw them. And sometimes it's good. I mean, when you're preparing for trial, sometimes it evolves and it needs to. Sometimes you're like, wow, I really should have been thinking about that earlier. But that one worked out for me. It really threw them for a loop, that they were just so like that. We didn't think that was it. They were just like, we're just going to wave opening.
Wow. Waving opening. That's a questionable tactic. You stop becoming amazed at some of the boneheaded tactics that some of these defense lawyers use.
Well, that's the funny thing is, then the judge was like, okay, your first witness. And you know how you like lay everything out for trial? And I'm like, okay, where is my first witness? Because I'm spending this hour and a half opening.
Well, Christian, we really appreciate your doing the podcast with us. This hour is absolutely flown by. I hope if you make it to Maine someday, we can connect up, maybe get a cup of coffee and chat or something. But it's great to meet you via Zoom. And thanks again. And congrats on all of your amazing success.
Thank you.
And congrats also on inspiring everybody. You're doing such a great job teaching at the ranch, teaching and educating lawyers every chance you've got, being an active part of Justice to Verdicts and the listservs. I mean, you're awesome, Christian.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it, both of you guys.
And then if anybody wants to reach out to you who hasn't already, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
So, well, you know, now I have my own firm, Christian Morris Trial Attorneys.
The sign looks amazing, by the way.
Thank you. It took me a year to get it up because the HOA, I didn't know HOAs were so powerful and difficult. So it's Christian at ChristianMorrisTrialAttorneys.com, CMTrialAttorneys.com. But, you know, I mean, this day and age, it's so funny. The other day, someone said, do you have a business card? And I'm like, I don't. But I feel like if you just Google Christian Morris, you're going to get a black basketball player or me. Because there's a dude out there with my name. But no, it's Christian at CMTrialAttorneys.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us.
Yes. Thank you guys both for having me. And I love that there's the West Coast presence that is my current life and the East Coast presence, which is my former life, even though I'll always be a maniac. So it's kind of a perfect blend. I love it.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.